Okay, so tonight we are taking another look at Parshas Toldot. This is a story where we have Yitzchak and Rivka, or Isaac and Rivka, Rebecca, are married. They go through a period of infertility. They pray and they are gifted a children. They Rivka has twins who are become Jacob and Esav, Yaakov and Esav. And the boys grow up and mayhem ensues. Okay, that's basically the Parsha. And we're going to take a little slice of that. The title of the class is, Are You Getting in Your Own Way? Are you getting in your own way? So I'm going to start off with a video. I don't think I've done too many Office clips, but everybody's favorite Michael Scott of The Office fame brings the idea in very nicely. So here we go. Just I'm gonna cue it up, as it were. The scene is Phyllis, who's a character in The Office. She works for, and her boss is Michael Scott. She's getting married, and Michael Scott was given the kavod of pushing her father down the aisle with in a wheelchair as Phyllis walks down with him. Okay? And then, of course, madness ensues. Here we go. So this is Michael Scott, The Office, walking Phyllis down the aisle. Here we go.
This strapping young lad sitting here is Phyllis's father, Albert, and he is quite the ladies' man, aren't you, Albert? Huh? Ah, ring bearer. I could have done better. I will do better. I am going to be better. I can't believe I'm actually doing this. Whew. Are you ready for this, Albert? I am. Let's do it!
That's my dress.
Me walking Phyllis down the aisle was supposed to be the highlight of the wedding. And now, the wedding has no highlight. I can't believe I pushed that guy's lazy ass around all day until he was ready to stand up and steal the show. That's, well, I got news for you, Albert. That's your real name. Show's not over.
Do you, Phyllis, take Bob Vance Refrigeration, to be your lawfully wedded husband?
I do.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I present to you, for the first time as a couple, Mr. and Mrs. Bob Vance!
And do you, Bob, take Phyllis to be your lawfully wedded wife?
I do.
You may now kiss the bride.
Ladies and gentlemen, for the first time as a couple, Mr. and Mrs. Hoffman!
All right. Nothing like a good cringe-worthy
clip. Classic. From... Classic.
All right. All right. Okay. All right, let's dissect this. Get to the... All right, so why does Michael Scott need to drag the wheelchair down the aisle and make an announcement at Phyllis's wedding? I mean, you know, his job was to push Phyllis's dad down the aisle. Phyllis's dad felt energized and comfortable to actually walk his daughter down the aisle. What's going on here?
He needed to have some of the spotlight on him. He craved it.
100%. He was, as he says in the, you know, in the classic, you know, The Office aside, you know, he, in his mind, viewed that his participation, his pushing the wheelchair down, walking Phyllis down, it wasn't even walking the dad down, it was walking Phyllis down, was going to be the highlight, the spotlight of the entire wedding. And as he said, well, now it doesn't have a spotlight. So therefore, how did he compensate for that? He did a couple of things. I don't know if you guys noticed it. He did a couple of activities that maximized all eyes would be upon him. I don't know if you caught it all. It was actually well done.
He dragged the wheelchair down the aisle in like that zigzag and then gave...
You know, what should he have done?
He just like pushed it and like gone off to the side.
Yeah. The reason why it wasn't moving because it was locked. He should have unlocked the wheelchair and then quietly pushed it down the aisle just in case dad needed the assistance. So why did he specifically not unlock it?
Because he wanted that like that slow step to milk like every second of it.
Every second. Now, what should he have done based upon common decency and normal protocol? What should he have done after he got the wheelchair down the aisle?
Taken his spot at the end of the line and kept his mouth shut.
No. I mean, that's true, yes, but where should he have sat?
In one of the pews.
In one of the pews. He's not part of the wedding party. You know what I'm saying? He's not a brother of Phyllis. You know, that's a king-size chutzpah. And you saw, you know, and he tried to squeeze in between Phyllis's brothers or the brother-in-law, whatever, and they wouldn't let him, you know what I mean? So he pushed his way in there because he didn't want to make a scene.
Are you sure about that, Rapini? I mean, that part's true, but he was wearing the exact thing of all the guys on the line.
He did. If you notice, he did not have the corsage.
I thought he did have it.
But I do remember...
With the tie and everything, whatever. But the point is very well... Either way, whether or not the pew or not, either way, to get up there, he could have went to the back and quietly been the next guy or whatever.
Right. Also, and then as Shayna pointed out, not only did that, he was so excited to, you know, participate in the ceremony. In the middle of the vows, he interrupts the chasen and kala with, ladies and gentlemen, presenting Mr. and Mrs. Bob, you know, whatever. I don't know what their name was. He got it, or he didn't even interrupt. Normally, he didn't even do it at the appropriate time. He's so anxious to, you know, get some attention. Okay. So, which of course gets me to the relevant question here: what's his problem? What is the psychology here? What's his problem?
He desperately wants to fall in love and get married, and so like being part of the weddings are like a thing for him. It's like a thing he wants to be a part of for him. So he's like, this is like his little slice of it.
Is it because of love? Well, there's a more basic, what's his psychological issue? There's a psychological issue here. Chaim Fishov writes down, his inner child is screaming, I want attention, I want love. Yeah, what do we call such a child who's an adult? Well, it is ego. This is a narcissist.
I can't think of it.
He's so narcissistic. He's so engaged in self-love, self-centered, that he has a profound case of unawareness. He picks up no cues. The whole comedic premise of The Office is Michael Scott, who has very low psychological self-awareness, will say inappropriate things, funny things. I just has no understanding of what his impact with others is. You know what I'm saying? He's just, so the question, of course, is, so why do we all love to watch this? I mean, in other words, this was a medium-level cringe-worthy Michael Scott clip. I could have found even more uncomfortable, awkward, well-orchestrated, cringe-worthy things. America,
around, not why we watch this. This is why they do it, because this is what is something that the comedy world is looking to create, characters that are relatable, and we could identify from that human aspect in us, each little part of it, and the ridiculousness of it, and laugh at it.
But what is ridiculous? But what is some of the aspects of the appeal?
The appeal is because we can relate to that part of us inside us that needs that fit, that love, that attention, but just hopefully not to that level. But we, right. The character is relatable in that aspect.
As Chaim has pointed out, we all of us have a little bit of Michael Scott in us. Some people have a lot of Michael Scott. Some people got a small amount, but you got that amount. People want to have attention. People like attention. People don't like to be ignored. People like to be noticed. People like to be appreciated. People like to be lifted up, identified as special. Obviously, he's now. Also, the question is now: the premise of the whole sitcom is, why isn't he hated? He's not hated, generally. Why is he not hated? This narcissistic person would be just simply like, just annoying to be with.
Because they didn't create him as an evil character. They created him as a good, normal, relatable person that has this stuff going on.
No, but there's obviously got to be some parts to him which makes everybody an attraction.
Well, there's moments of him where he's I want to say conscious of like his actions, and is actually very like thoughtful and heartfelt and caring, and not like wacky boss. You know what I mean? That we always love.
Scott, you are 100% correct. There, in other words, the writers very carefully calibrated. In other words, his in tremendous insensitivity, his absorptions, his self-centeredness, right, which create the craziness in The Office. While with another are with various actions of him being lovable and thoughtful and doing something, helpful, you know what I'm saying? Or they have to make him, they can't make him too annoying, because then nobody's gonna watch the show. And or by extension, the show becomes unbelievable, because otherwise it'd be just simply a mutiny in The Office, and they'd say, you gotta get rid of this guy. He's killing us. You know what I'm saying? If you have somebody who was so self-absorbed and obnoxious and indifferent to the plight of their worker, basically, what happens? People leave. Okay. So the bottom line is that the writers, who've been awarded numerous Emmys were masterful in creating the right recipe of Michael Scott. One part narcissist, one part lovable guy, which creates fantastic, comedic, awkward, cringeworthy moments that it's like you want to look away, but you just can't. Okay. So that's the secret sauce of The Office. And that's why, of course, it was such a powerfully successful series. They can go on. If they announce they're going to do another year of The Office, they could easily get it. I mean, it was on Netflix. It's going to go, I don't think it's on Hulu. I don't know where it's migrating, but the bottom line is it's this is going to be in syndication for forever. You know, it's going to be like Seinfeld, syndicated forever. Anyways, with that introduction, you don't know where I'm, how I'm going to link this one. Michael Scott to the Parsha. So let's take a look at the Parsha here. Here we go. All right, let me have, okay, so let's. Matthew, would you like to read this from this over here?
Sure. So chapter 25, verse 24. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twins in her womb. The first one came out reddish, as hairy as a fur coat. They named him Esav. His brother then emerged, and his hand was grasping Esav's heel. Isaac named him Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. The boys grew up. Esav became a skilled trapper, a man of the field. Jacob was a scholarly man who remained in the tents. Isaac loved Esav. After all, Esav's game was in his mouth. But Rebekah loved Jacob.
Okay. So we have the Torah, interestingly enough, actually, you know, rather rarely, goes into some of the biographical information here, which is not the norm. You know, Yitzchak's birth, he's born. There's a mention that he's weaned at three, and that's it. There's no mention. Here, where the Torah is specifically going into some of the, is going into a little bit of giving us some biographical information. Now, it's important to understand the dynamic later in the Parsha. And as it says, as was told to Rivka earlier, that she has not just two children, but two nations in her belly. In other words, these two children are going to ultimately be leaders of two different civilizations. Yaakov will be, of course, the Jewish people, and Esav ultimately will be like the Roman Empire, and basically, you know, the Western world, essentially. So, all right. So now, here's a question. But then you get this very enigmatic pasuk. We're going to focus on pasuk 28. Yitzchak loved Esav. After all, Esav's game was in his mouth, but Rivka loved Yaakov. So the question is, did Yitzchak love Esav to the exclusion of Yaakov? What do you guys say? What would you say? What would you guess? What would be your aspect? What would you think? By the way, before you answer that, let me back up and let me ask a more general question. Do parents have favorites?
They say no. But from the child's perspective, it often feels like they do.
Okay. What do you say, Matthew? You're giving the nod. You're saying, what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I know my dad always said, like, my sister is his favorite daughter and I'm his favorite son. So that's like a way of covering it. But I would say I would agree with Shayna that they say they don't, but one child does. Feel there's a favorite because there's always one child who's going to be like getting the other hand in some situations.
Okay, Chaim, are your children with you tonight? All right, so what do you say, Chaim? You a father of five kids. Do parents have favorites? I'm not going to ask you which, you know, if you do, so if there are favorites, which one? We're not going to. This is being recorded, so I don't want to. What do you say?
I'm not so ashamed either to say that I definitely know parents that do have favorites. I think I have each one. I could even say I don't have a favorite, but there's a few things like more in some than others. But I think for me and for many parents, we love our kids to a very special extent. And the things that I know for myself that I identify with my kids in certain areas or that I don't, but I wish or they accomplish, I can like feel extra attached or an extra love for that character trait or that thing that I see inside them.
That very political thing. So you're coming down with a resounding yes.
Yes, each is a different favorite for different things. So it's okay, not like
one right, thing. Right. I'm not gonna
like a more love, but like for certain things, there's they get extra brownie, extra points
all
on
right,
the favorite, well, on the favorite okay. spectrum.
Okay, Scott, what do you say, Scott? Parents have favorites?
I would say, you know, to a point, like, you always think, you know, younger child gets away with, like, a lot because of the baby, or the oldest child is held to like a higher standard because like they're the firstborn. You know what I mean? Middle child always gets like lost in the middle, kind of.
Yes. Got that. Okay. Julie, what says you?
So besides the fact that there are like different gender roles that like a father or mother can relate to the child, depending on the child you're talking about, I think there are certain traits that a parent can relate to someone and that they see in their child. So that could, I guess, lean towards favoritism for that reason.
Right. Okay. So
there's a having a favorite and showing favoritism. Two separate things.
Well, okay. That point well taken. In other words, I don't think that, by the way, I think all your parents who deny it are making an intelligent parenting move. We're going to go into the next parshiot where Yaakov openly displayed his favoritism to Yosef, and basically it ripped the family apart. The other brothers could not handle that. So keeping it vague is the way to go. Having a favorite, we see from the avot, from the patriarchs, is 100% natural. It's normal. Just like you have a best friend, you don't love all your friends equally. Why would you assume you love all your children equally? As Shana says, that's the marketing. I love all my children equally. That's not to say they don't love all their children, nor they can love all their children. But they can love, as Chaim pointed out, there could be some qualities, some skills, some talents, some things that the connection and you feel stronger about. Okay, so that's just not that's a reasonable possibility. Okay, I guess also possible you could love your children equally. I guess it's theoretically possible, but is it possible to love all your friends equally? No, there's you have your best friend and you have a couple best friends. And not only that, it's probably in a state of flux. I mean, obviously, I'm pretty sure that your best friend in fourth grade is not currently your best friend. It could be. Unlikely. They might be your best friend from high school. They might be your best friend from college years. They might be your best friend now. You know, people's friendship, people are constantly entering in your life and leaving your life. And people grow in closeness and decrease in closeness. And that's the nature of all relationships. So point number one is the Torah, the Tanakh, clearly talks about favoritism. And they also talk about when favoritism is expressed, that's a bad thing. To have a favorite seems to be normal. To express who the favorite is, bad idea. You got to go to the grave with that secret. That's a secret. You got to do come Hanukkah, you don't get one kid one teeny gift and one kid one mega gift. That's not cool. All the kids, because by the way, kids are watching. Kids have a radar to detect, is there any additional favoritism being handed out? They're very particular about that. If somebody's getting a $25 gift or a $50 gift, everybody's got to get the same level. It can't be one person's and if they are going to get a bigger gift, there better be a big and reasonable explanation to explain the difference, because already they're not happy and they're going to express it. So come Hanukkah time, you got to be even Steven. That's it. And when it's not, kids know and they are upset, because no child wants to feel that they're the unloved one or the less loved one. That's a disaster. Okay, are we clear upon that? Now, with that basic introduction, we can ask the basic question. Did Yitzchak love Esav to the exclusion of Yaakov? It says, Isaac loved Esav after all of the game was in his mouth. But Rivka loved Yaakov. So what do you say? Did Yitzchak love Esav to the exclusion of Yaakov? What would you say? Julie immediately shook her head. Why did you immediately shake your head?
Well, I mean, when you're saying it's like black and white, which it's not. Like, it's not all or nothing. That's my opinion. I mean, he had two children, so I just don't believe it's all or nothing.
Right. It's not like a parent has, I only got enough love for one kid. Sorry, you get nothing. So
And they're also great in their own ways. Like, sure, like the one son's a great hunter, but the other one's like a scholarly, like a, I don't know, like some sort of like educator. Like, you know what I mean?
Well, and again, well, let me ask you this question. Do we love our children because of what they accomplish?
No.
In other words, we have to love our children, in general, in an unconditional factor, whether the child is a superstar, whatever, or not a superstar, just a regular person. You want the person to be a good person. You want them to be independent. You want them to be psychologically well. I mean, it's what you want your child to be. What they accomplish, that's not, your love should not be modulate based upon that. That gets you into problems, because then the child feels that I have a conditional love. Oh, if I get A's and I get to Harvard, then you love me. But if I don't, I will feel that the love will be withdrawn and I'm going to be feeling very insecure. That's terrible. You want to communicate to your child that you love your child unconditionally. Now, obviously, if it gets a wicked person, that's, I'm saying love a murderer. But all things being equal, you got to love your children and express your love regardless if one kid's a genius and one kid's not. One's great and one's a great athlete, one's not. One's great business, one's not. Makes a difference. You're a child. You got to show love. Because it's your responsibility to nourish them to become healthy people. And they can't be healthy people without you giving them a clear message of love. So I would agree with Julie that why would you assume the assumption is that parents love their kids, period. The fact that the Torah is identifying that Yitzchak loved Esav, well, that apparently is a special reason. He gave a reason because apparently Esav, who's a hunter, is bringing home food. Now, which gets to question number 6. Was Yitzchak influenced by a steady stream of venison dinners? In other words, let's say Esav did not bring home the dinners, did not bring home the steak. Would Yitzchak not love him? What do you say?
I would hope not, as that's making his love conditional.
Right, and not only conditional, but conditional on a very low thing. In other words, oh, I only love you because I get steak dinners out of you. If you had a friend like that, what kind of friendship would that be? Oh, I like you because you give me stuff. That's a very superficial and very lowly thing. And we're talking about Yitzchak. We have to assume he's a special person. He's a thoughtful person. He's a developed person, a moral person. So there has to be what is the question? Of course, which is the challenge of all the commentaries is like, what is exactly this Sayyid Befiv, that hunting was in his mouth? What is that really all about? We're going to check a look. We will explore that a little bit. And did Rivka love Esav at all? But Rebecca loved Yaakov. What do you say? What do you guys say?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same as like question 5, that the fact is she probably did love both children, but she favored one above the other for different reasons. And since they were going to be the children, if she had this vision, they were going to be they're going to have two nations in her belly, then for some reason she leaned towards Jacob early on, maybe.
Yeah, now it's interesting. It does not, by Yitzchak gives a reason. But Rivka does not give a reason. Didn't say, but Rivka loved Yaakov, because he learned all the time. Or because he was a great scholar. You know, he was a Yoshev Ohalim. Doesn't say that. It's interesting. It is a little bit enigmatic. Okay, so therefore, whenever you have, by the way, you should know in general, the Tanakh, in general, expressed itself sometimes enigmatically as a way to convey multiple ideas. That was a literary device that Torah employs. Okay? It doesn't tell you everything in a concrete, direct, crystal clear way. It is a strategy. Okay, so we're going to talk about a few of the comments. Where's my other text? So I'm going to go back to the other. We're going to go. let's pick it up from here. Matthew, you're doing a great job. Pick it up from this midrash here. Go ahead.
Sure. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel in Devarim Rabbah states, "No one honored a father more than me, and I have found that the honor Esav showed for his father was even greater. Esav's concern for his father is even found clearly in the text. Bereishit chapter 27, verse 41 informs us that after Yaakov is tricked with the blessing, Esav says to himself that soon it will be the mourning period for his father, and then he will kill Yaakov. He refrains from attacking Yaakov immediately because of the pain it would cause to his father."
Okay, so this is the midrash that, interestingly enough, that Esav was a Hall of Famer of showing kibud av em, showing honor to parents. Mm-hmm. So taking that approach, so the way that Yitzchak seemed to interpreted Esav bringing the food was that was his way of service. Esav was an elderly man. Yitzchak was an elderly man. So as he's the way that, and Esav was a hunter, so he could have hunted animals and had barbecues with his buddies or sold it, but he apparently, as a regularity, wanted to show cover to his dad by getting him food. So
which is one of those things we always talk about, right? When somebody has the special talents, right, to use them in their highest best form.
Right. So therefore you can take this approach one angle. Again, it's open to a little variation of approach, but one approach is that Yitzchak loved Esav because here's a guy. He loved Yaakov. Well, Yaakov, of course, was like him, essentially, was a person who dwelt in tents, very scholarly, a learned person who was seeking Hashem, person who was a honorable and, perfected, good mitos kind of person, right? But the chiddush is that he also loved Esav because Esav's a guy, as just to riff off what Chaim says, that this is a guy whose personality as an extrovert is different, but yet he's using his talents in the mitzvah fashion. So he also had an affection for him. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So that's one way we can approach it. But Rivka apparently not so impressed. Rivka not so impressed. All right, so we're going to check out, this is the Radak.
Just curious, Rabbi, there were bad things that were said about Esav and known about Esav, right, as he was the person he was. Yitzchak, I mean, Rivka did, she got to know about that stuff. Did those messages get to Yitzchak?
So let me just bring everybody into that conversation, Chaim. What Chaim is referencing is that there are midrashim that paint Esav in a very bad fashion. Okay? But we're building out pshat first. Right now, there's nothing bad right here mentioned. He just saying he's a hunter. Nothing wrong with being a hunter. What's the crime? He's not like his brother. Okay. All right, he's later on. He sells his birthright for a bowl of soup. That is obviously not so impressive. Later on, he marries local women, two Chitad women, who on their own initiative do avodah zarah, which obviously makes his parents very upset. Oh, but when he hears that his parents are upset, he goes ahead, doesn't divorce his wife, he gets a new wife. So from the open text, the Torah does not openly come down crushingly hard. What Chaim brings down the Midrash and specifically brought down by Rashi create a harsh indictment. Now, the Radak, that's a contraction, name is Rabbi David Kimchi, living in the 1200s. Okay. He is what they call a Pashtan. There are commentaries this goes back to what Shane asked me a question on the Halacha chat about Pshat and Drash last week's Parsha. So you can organize the Meforshim into different kind of commentators. And there's a debate because Rashi is also saying he does Pshat and Drash. Radak also is also a, he's a grammarian, like Rashi, and he takes a very pshat-based approach, but he will also bring in the midrashim after the effect. So we're going to take a look how the Radak reads these psukim, these verses. We're gonna take it apart, and we're going to try to have some understanding. And then, of course, we're going to close it out because I can't disappoint Scott, who we're going to, of course, have some scenarios from applications to our lives, obviously. That's it. That's it. All right, so let's go. Let's keep on going. So, Julie Bavakasha, let's read out the Radak.
Okay. As soon as they grew up, their activities diverged completely from one another, one concentrating on mundane activities which showed immediate profitable results, the other concentrating on the acquisition of knowledge, wisdom, example, abstract matters. One was an extrovert at home in the fields or mountains, etc., whereas the other was an introvert, as reflected in the term
Yoshev Ohalim, Yoshev Ohalim, dweller of tents. Okay, so Radak's first comment is that the boys grew up, but even though the twins, I guess the key point is that oftentimes twins are similar or they differ a little bit. But here, what the Torah teaches us that these are twins, they're fraternal twins, they're not identical twins, but they are like 180 degrees different. They are radically different people. One's an introvert, one's an extrovert. One is a scholarly person. He lives in tents. The other one is out in the field, out and about, and he's out there. He's out in the world. All right, Ohalim, go on. Keep on reading. Ohalim tents. Go on.
The reason why the Torah wrote this word in the plural mode is because Yaakov studied with any wise man he came across. He was indiscriminating in this regard, being totally devoid of deceit or evil, wanting only to amass knowledge.
So the Radak picks up, because he's a grammarian, he says, why doesn't it say Yoshev Ohel, dweller of a tent? Why is it Yoshev Ohalim, dweller of tents? So therefore it seems that he is going from tent to tent. Well, what tents is he going to? So apparently, keeping in the same idea, is that he would be a person who was basically a seeker of wisdom, going to people, various tents of wisdom, and learning from every people. He's a lifelong learner. He is a motivated seeker of truth. That's what the Radak says. That's why that Torah expressed it that way. We keep on going. Now we get to our thing. And Yitzchak loved. Vayehav, go on.
There was no need to mention that Yitzchak loved Yaakov. Clearly, his love for Yaakov was constantly on the increase, seeing that Yaakov was righteous, etc. Esau claimed his father's love was due only to the venison he brought his father from his hunting expedition.
Okay. So it's interesting, like Julie pointed out earlier, he certainly loved Yaakov, but not because of the default that he's a child, because he sees that Yaakov is such a righteous guy. But Yitzchak still loved Esau because of the venison. Now let's keep on going. Befiv, it's in his mouth.
This meat was especially tasty. Moreover, Yitzchak was already aged, being more than 70 years old. Clearly, unless Esau had been at least 12 years old at the time, he would not have known how to hunt with bow and arrow.
Okay, by the way, this is a clear proof that that the Avot, the patriarchs, did not keep kosher. Who can show how this proves that Yitzchak did not keep kosher? Open proof.
I mean, it's obvious. You guys can get it. I, Scott, Shada, Julia, you guys can get it. Matt, I don't know you, but you can probably get it too.
How is it? There's a clear proof that that Yitzchak did not keep the kosher laws.
I'm cheering on for you guys. Come on, you guys got this.
How was the animal slaughtered?
Yeah. How was when Esau brings the meat home? How did he kill the animal?
his bow and arrow instead of.
Are you? Is that a good? What they call? Is that a ritual slaughtering?
We're assuming it's a trefa. There's no right. So.
No, you can't. You shoot it. You shoot. You kill an animal with a bow and arrow. He's a hunter. He's not doing ritual slaughter. He's not trapping the animal and carefully slaughtering its neck. You know what I mean? He is killing it with a bow and arrow. Okay. So just to reference, you will hear the famous Midrash that the patriarchs and matriarchs kept all the Torah and all the mitzvot, even the rabbinic laws. Okay. Rashi brings that down. The Ramban has a lengthy comment on that.
And last week's parsha, as the Medrit Rabbi Bachaya says, that the Yitzchak learned Torah on the mountain for 3-4 years after the Akedah. That's where he was hanging out.
Well, okay, so far.
That's why he was at his mother's funeral.
Okay, so that's interesting. But first of all, also, you can ask a better question, but what Torah is there to learn if there's no revelation of the Torah yet?
Yeah, what the concepts are, that's and Yeshiva Shem Ve'Aver, we see that, right? Yeah, we went there.
Yeah, so Shem Ve'Aver, for example, I'll just bring everybody into the conversation. So the Midrash says that Yaakov, who's going to, at the end of the parsha, is going to flee from his brother, is for 14 years, is going to spend time in a Yeshiva program by the biblical Shem, which is Noach's son, and Aver, okay? Two guys. Of course, is what did Yaakov learn for 14 years when there is no written law, there is no oral law? What are they learning? So the basic idea is that the learning was basically what Avram brought to the world, which is what we would call in modern day, he was teaching about philosophy and ethics and morality, how to be a person who knows Hashem, believes in Hashem, and live a good life. You know what I mean, there's those conversations. It wasn't discussing about how one washes their hands in the morning when they wake up. That was not the conversation that they had. So what does it mean that the patriarchs kept all the mitzvot? So the Rambam's son, Avram, says he understands that mitzvot mean that the patriarchs, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, were on such a lofty level that they fundamentally intuited all the ideas and the benefits of the mitzvot incorporated into their world, their personality. And they had the perfection, the quality of the refinement of character that the mitzvot give, but they did it without the help of the mitzvot themselves. In fact, we learn the mitzvot from them. The way that they conduct themselves becomes the archetype of the mitzvot. How do you do hachnasas orchim? How do you welcome in the guests? Look how Avram did it, okay? So we see certain models of perfection and excellence from the patriarchs. So here you see that Yitzchak is eating venison, delicious meat, killed by a bow and arrow by his own son.
Okay. Rabbi, you want to hear something cool here just in that topic that I saw recently?
Dead.
So the Orcha the ways of the Sadiqim, Sefer Orcha Sadiqim, in the Shara Torah, he talks about the studying of his own sake and labor of laws. It says that somebody who does study in his own sake for the labor of laws, his two kidneys become like two springs, and he produces reasons and halachas himself. What had never been learned before, learned and what had never been given even to Moshe at Sinai, as we find in respect to Avram, Bereshis Rabbah, Tetzvav last week, I think it was, who a blessed memory, who never was taught by any man, but who sat and reflected by himself concerning mitzvahs, and in this way derived the whole of Torah and mitzvahs. The pasuk says on Abraham, and he kept my mitzvahs, right? Chavav hei, and says Veishmar Mishmarti mitzvosai who kosev is a rasai. The pasuk says on Abraham, and that's what the Gemara says, that he even knew even Erev Tashilin. Right. That's Gemara in Yuma on 28b, and also in Gemara Avodah Zarah that Avram Avinu learned 400 prakim of chapters of Mishnayos of Avodah Zarah. And who taught him this? His kidneys became like two springs from which they flowed to him wisdom and Torah. And that we found in Perek Rabbi Lazar.
Right. So that's not to be taken literally, but figuratively, that Avram's intuition was that the ideas of the mitzvos, which each mitzvah has an idea or ideas, he was able to figure out himself. So that's what this is. So, but that's not necessarily mean that they kept ritually. They didn't put on tefillin in the morning. In other words, they didn't make a seder to celebrate the fact that the Jew people in 400 years will leave Egypt. You know what I mean? They didn't put on tefillin as a commemoration of the exodus of Egypt, which did not yet happen. Right? You know, right? So, but as you are quoting there from Orchas HaTzadikim is referring that he figured out on his own. In the ancient, they believed that the kidneys were the source of wisdom. That's from the ancient biology.
Right. Avram did, and he did eat matzah on Pesach, it says, right? So that he made, it was Pesach. That's why they made Ugo's cakes, right? Matzahs.
All right. So the question is, it comes down to one question. Are you taking these midrashim literally? He's eating matzah because it's the 15th day, the night of the 15th of Nisan. It's Seder night. Or there's another idea that can be conveyed in that. So I'm going with option B. All right, let's keep on going. I thought that was a little bit of a side thing. All right, Rivka Hevet Yaakov. Let's keep on going. Who was reading? I even forgot. Who was reading? I don't know. Who was reading before?
I guess I was.
Yes. Thank you, okay. Julia. Pardon.
Okay.
Rivka Hevet Yaakov. Rivka loved Yaakov. Go on.
Exclusively. The reason was that Yaakov pursued a lifestyle that would lead to eternal life, whereas Esau did the opposite. Not only did he not lead a life leading to eternal life after death, but he actively forfeited even life on earth, exposing himself to needless dangers. Seeing that Yitzhak was aging and sitting at home most of the time, he was not aware of Esau's doings and was easily led to believe that Esau led a virtuous life, basing his belief on the daily supply of venison his son provided for him. The story unfolds at a time when Yitzhak was already incapable of seeing well with his physical eyes. The story of the sale of the birthright is told primarily to illustrate the disdain with which Esau looked upon spiritual values as a valuable acquisition, something guaranteeing a person life beyond death.
Okay, so the Radak comes down harshly. He learns that Rivka loved Yaakov exclusively because this is a guy who's living a good moral life, and this guy's living an immoral life, okay? And the fact that he sells his birthright for a bowl of beans indicates that he didn't really value spiritual things at all. So Radak is taking a very harsh reading of the pasuk. Okay, so, which of course...
How could she not like Esav enough for that? I mean, she's the one. We don't see them. If we're going just based on Pshat and Pasuk, they didn't teach them about how to live. They don't see any.
All right. So hold on. So hold on. I'm going to address your question. Stay tuned. That's really getting to our next question here. You're based on the Radak. Why would Yitzchak love Esav more because of the hunting that he brought home? What does it tell us about the impact of bribery, even on a great man? How do you think Yitzchak justified his love for Esav as seen by the Midrash? What do you guys see? According to the Radak, how he's reading it in a non-charitable way. What's going on here?
I mean, I don't know, perhaps on a practical level, I mean, if he's doing something for the family and he's bringing home venison, perhaps Yitzhak's going to look at him more favorably.
Why? What does it tell you about the impact of receiving, giving and receiving of gifts? Actually, this even alludes to something we have later on in the Torah that talks about shochad. Shochad is the Hebrew word for bribery. Shochad yaver einei tzadikim. Yaver tzadikim. That bribery perverts the words of the righteous.
But again, it was easy. There was two things here, though. One, it says here that Esav was unaware of Esav's doing. Yitzhak was unaware, which I would say that means that it is going with what I was implying earlier, where there was those behaviors, and his wife knew, but she didn't tell Yitzhak because it wasn't going to help the situation because she was out there more. He was in bed all day. At least at this age, and because he was incapable of seeing physical eyes, better leave him that way. Also, earlier on number 27, the idea of profitable results, he was a success, he was the businessman, he was other things. He probably had good reports on that too. So all in all, that he has an all-around picture.
Right. So basically,
as Yaakov's just going around getting knowledge and being a color guy.
Right. So what Chaim, to unpack what Chaim just mentioned, is that basically the way the Radak is depicting it is that Yitzchak loved Esau because he was providing for the family. He interpreted it as what? A tremendous gesture of kibbutz av. He interpreted favorably, but that aided to his being blinded by the circumstances. And Esav wanted his father's love. Okay, which is a normal thing. So it's there, but why is Rivka not fooled? Why is Rivka not fooled? What do you guys say? Matthew, why was Rivka not fooled to the nature of Esav?
She gave birth to him, so she knows who he really is.
Well, I mean, is the birth factor the thing? First of all, by the way, Rivka is at least twenty, is way younger than Yitzchak. Okay, just you should know that. He was 40 years old married. She seems to be somewhere in that 15 to 20. It seems to be there easily a 20-year gap. Easily. So what's the pshah? Why is Rivka? There's a couple reasons about Rivka's keen eye. You have to know a little bit about last week's parsha, this week's parsha. What makes Rivka not able to discern, shall we say, call things as they are? What do you guys say? Shayna?
Are you referring to her, the Medrash?
Well, I said, no, not the Medrash. I want to look at Shayna, why is Rivka able to, shall we say, see things as they are?
First of all, she had the prophecy, where she knew what was going to happen.
Yes, number one, she had the advantage that they knew about what the destiny of these children, but that really goes to their descendants. It wasn't necessarily about them, per se. That helped, that was helpful. But what, even more immediate than that, where does Rivka grow up? Who's her brother?
Lavan.
What is Lavan? Guy is Lavan?
He's the master of deception.
He's the master of deception. You see later on, he tricks Yaakov, he changes his salary dozens of times.
And then the wife swap.
Right, the wife swap, the whole nine yards. So the bottom line is Rivka is what you would call a very savvy person, number one. Number two, Yitzchak is older. His physical eyesight is lacking. Rivka's at home. She sees what's going on. She knows the deal. Rivka knows the score. That's why she orchestrates the whole thing, that she does not want Esav to be coronated as being the leader of the family because she feels that will be deleterious. But going to what Chaim says, but she could not express that to him because Yitzchak would apparently not believe it. Because Esav had done such a great job of presentation. He's a successful person. He shows tremendous kibbutz av. He has great regard for his father. So it's a difficult situation. Now, this is a very important question. This really goes through an insight that Ray Mann shared with me. What did Yitzchak think about Esav's talents of a hunter, which is directed by kibbutz av, could do for the future of the Jewish people? In other words, Yitzchak, according to the Radak, knew that Yaakov was a scholar, righteous person, knew that Esav was the extrovert, knew he was a hunter. What was his vision for the Jewish people? What was Yitzchak's vision for the Jewish people?
Wow. I like that. I'm guessing that the idea that the Jews could protect themselves in war and have the best of both worlds of physical and material wealth and spiritual wealth.
Exactly. As Chaim pointed out, Ray Mann shared with me that basically Yitzchak's idea was, it's not a problem that Esav, who he is, the world needs people like Esav. The world needs people like Yaakov. They have opposite skill sets. We will make a coalition of both children. These two boys will grow up to be joint leaders. This will be the person who will be involved in statecraft, running the government, dealing with people, warfare. And this person will be the spiritual leader, the Kohen, the Moshe, the Aaron. You know what I'm saying? He will, in order, so therefore, you'll have, the, as Chaim says, you'll have the best of both worlds fused into two people. The brothers will work together. And what did basically Rivka say to his dream? What did Rivka, with the whole later on, with the entire deception, what was basically Rivka thinking about the best of both world combination poo-poo platter approach to Jewish leadership? What did she say about that? What do you guys say?
It's impossible among my midst.
Right. It's not, these two boys cannot, they can't, it's not going to work together. It's not going to, in other words, in simple Lashon, it ain't happening. They're not going to work together. In other words, Yitzchak had a much more charitable vision of Esav and thought that working together would work. And she says, ain't happening. Notice very similar to what Sarah said to Avram. Oh, she sent out Yishmael from Yitzchak. What did Avram believe? Well, they'll grow up together. They'll work together. It's always the women that seem to have the clairvoyant sense that knowing when things are going to work, when is there going to be a shidduch, and when is there not going to be a shidduch. And women, by the way, generally are what they call, Chazal always crown women with the quality that women are often gifted with the bina yisera, the extra intelligence, which I understand to mean is that there's a psychological or social understanding that women are far more gifted toward. Like just like Michael Scott has no awareness, women are gifted with profound social acuity and awareness. Okay, and Rivka was even aided by the prophecy, as Shana pointed out, to understand that these two boys are going to be two leaders of two nations that are going in opposite directions. There is not working together here. It ain't not happening. Okay, we got a couple of minutes left for some scenarios. Scenario number one. Joe MGR is married and has his first child, Eitan. Eitan, after keeping the couple up all night, gets into the arts and craft drawer and spills paint all over the carpet. Joe is furious. Joe turns to his wife and exclaims, "Why do we have kids?" How can he use Yitzchak's example to answer his question? How will Yitzchak guide Joe to reframe the picture of Eitan? What do you guys say? How would Yitzchak answer Joe?
If we go back to the metaphor of like being blind or turning a blind eye, it's looking past things like this. Like, yeah, he spilled paint all over the carpet, but you could potentially wash it or clean it. You may be more expensive and have to replace the carpet. But having the child, it's just one little incident, and you may be furious in the moment, but you have to see, like, or go back to, this is my son. I love my son. My son made a mistake. This is fixable.
100%. First of all, yes, he would say to him, Joe, my wife and I, Rebecca, waited 20 years to have a child. A child is always a supreme gift. It's a supreme gift. I thought I was not going to have kids. So number one is a gift. And number two, as Shana said, yes, the child made a big mess. And it might be you need to check, rip out the carpet. That might be the case. But the bottom line is that's, As Yitzchak was correct, I'm looking away from Esav. I know he's not the idealized guy, but he has other talents. Just because little Eitan is filling the paint does not mean the kid is devoid of any goodness. He's a little kid, and just the opposite, to reframe it, is that part of a child's exploration and learning about things will result in making a mess, because that's part of their developmental process. kids learn to grow and explore by getting into stuff. Okay. Sometimes it's messy. Sometimes it's not. But that's the good thing is celebrate the fact the kid's a healthy kid. If you're sitting there nearly comatose on a chair, you have bigger problems. Okay. If your kid is not making a mess ever, you got to bring that child that kid needs an intervention because that's the bigger problem. So the fact that the kid is acting, making messes, that's healthy city. Yes, it's freaking annoying. We all know that. And, you know, and he kept you up all night. But number one, appreciate the bracha of the child. Number two, this is normal and natural, and recognize that this is the talents of the child. Just like Yitzchak, in a certain sense, correctively had a very realistic vision. He didn't get angry at Esav and said, Esav, you're a loser for not being Yaakov. No, you're great. You're Esav. It's okay. He just didn't know that there were other issues, but he didn't have a problem with him being a hunter. That is something that can be used in a good way. And he thought he was. He didn't realize that he was getting a little bit blinded, a little bit deceived. We go to scenario number two. We only got three scenarios tonight. Jan MGR's friend Joan is extremely loyal and insightful. However, Joan's personality quirk of always being late to everything really gets on her nerves. After Joan was super late to a Shabbos lunch in which Jan and the other guests had to wait for 20 minutes, and she didn't even show up until 45 minutes later. In other words, they basically know this happened. This, by the way, is the oldest rule. When you have multiple guests, all right, the host is always announced, okay, we're waiting until 12:30, and then we're going to begin, right? That you should know, that's the rules, okay? And then Jane comes hopping in 45 minutes late. She comes in at 12:45. Lunch was called for 12, and she shows they wait hungrily till 12:20. So after Joan had left, Jan's other friends asked her, why are you still friends with Joan as she treats you so poorly? What would Yitzchak's answer be? How would Yitzchak reframe Joan's friendship to Jane? What do you say to Jan? You might have a friend like this. What do you say?
I mean, if she could just have like a compulsive habit of being late, it doesn't necessarily mean that she's like a bad friend.
Well, she says Joan is extremely loyal and insightful. She has good qualities. She just has this very annoying thing. This is very annoying, by the way. Okay, maybe, so go ahead, Matthew.
Maybe there's like something going on in her life, like, you know, personal life, which makes her late. Like, she doesn't intend to be late.
Yeah, that's very generous of you. But when a person always, in other words, like, you're known as, she's always late. She's consistent in her lateness. You know those the people? Like, you know they're going to be late. They're always late. They're late. They're late. They're late. They can't be on time to save their life, okay? So
if it's a consistent thing like that and she has these two great qualities, it would just be a situation where don't wait for her. Like, if she shows up when she shows up.
Right. So bottom line, what you're saying to me is that, look, and then what Julie else is, look, you cannot lose the big picture from the trees. Joan is a good friend. She's loyal. She's insightful. She may have other be very pleasant to be with. She just has a bad habit and you can't change it. And and basically, here's the reality. Every person is a little bit annoying. Everyone. Even me. Everyone. I might be even a lot more annoying. Whatever. But my point being is that, the question, you make a basic calculation. Is it worth it to have a good friend who's loyal, who's there for you, who's thoughtful? Okay. You got to pay. And in life, you always pay. It's just that the currency changes. Okay, the currency that Jane has to do is you have to put up with her being late. That's the currency. You gotta endure it. That's what the Pirkei Avos says. Kinei lecha chaver, literally buy yourself a friend. What do you mean buy yourself a friend? Which means sometimes you're gonna have a friend who brings out the best in you, but they're gonna have some annoying qualities which are gonna grate on you. You just suck it up because it's worth it. And that's the basic idea. So that's the idea. So Yitzchok would say, I didn't throw away Esav because he has good values. He shows a tremendous kibbutz. He's an extrovert. He's a person, he's a man of action. You know, he gets stuff done. He's a conqueror. This is a great guy. All right. He didn't see the whole picture, but there's, you know, Esav had virtue. He had good things. And in life, you have friends and you have to make a calculation. Sometimes people make the wrong calculation. In other words, they like the person's superficial qualities, easy to get along, but they don't realize that there are other qualities that are really harming them being a bad influence. You got to be very discriminating. What's important? What's not important? Person could be very, could really bring out the very best in you, but they could have some annoying qualities. And the price you have to pay is put up with their annoying qualities. Okay, that's the deal. That's the price. Can't make somebody not annoying. Very hard. Maybe spot. All right, last question. Dan MGR is very frustrated with his parents. They often embarrass them at family simchas with dad stories of his youth. You know what I'm talking about. How would Yitzchok help Stan with dealing with his parents, and how would he reframe his vision of his parents? This is a good one.
It's a tough one.
How do you deal with the fact you feel that your parents always embarrass you? And they can't, and they're like 60.
Well, to you, it's like an embarrassing story. To them, it's like a cute, like proud moment that pops in their head from time to time that they love to share with the other people, other, you know.
Okay. You know what I mean? So, but it really, okay. So what would Yitzchok help Stan in dealing with his parents? And how would he reframe his vision of his parents? There's one breakthrough you need to make with your parents. It's one breakthrough.
Communication?
Nope. There are two stages of relating to your parents. Stage one in your life is when you look at your parents through the lens of that they are your parents. And all the luggage of being mom and dad, you're filtered through that. So therefore, every time they tell a story, it's from all the accumulated stuff of their relationship. Then there's an awareness you have. Is it, you know something? My parents are also people separate from them being my parents. So they may be a 55-year-old, 60-year-old guy who just likes, as Scott said, who feels very affectionate about his kid and likes to share stories that are in his mind an expression of love. But to the child may is a sense of embarrassment. In other words, if you can step out of the realm of looking at your parents as your parents, but looking at them as two people, middle-aged people, who have certain good qualities and certain bad qualities, certain endearing qualities and certain annoying qualities, because everybody has that, you can then relate to them much better because you're not looking at them through the weight of all your collective issues for the last 20, 30, 40 years. Okay. So the bottom line is, if you could look at them as, who is this person other than my dad or my mom? What are they? What are their qualities? What are their bad qualities? What are their endearing qualities? What are their annoying qualities? And if you can relate to them in that sort of different perspective, your judgment of them will likely be far more kind and charitable. And therefore, you can deal with them because you don't relate to them under the full weight of all the luggage and baggage of the totality of them interacting with you as a parental figure for your whole life. You know what I'm saying? If you can look at them as there are these two middle-aged people who are happen to be your mom and dad, but look at them as just two middle-aged people who are not your parents, how would you assess them? How would you relate to them? Probably in a less emotionally charged way. So that really is sort of the secret sauce of, right? You know, many people are angry at their parents. They did this to me and they didn't do that to me. They got a whole list of all the wrongs they did. And that's not saying they did the parents are innocent. It's just saying that, okay, how would I relate to them as being just people? People who had these good qualities, bad, how would you look at them as being, how would a friend or a colleague look at them? Would they look at them in the same way? Probably not. So looking at them from the perspective in a much more objective third-party perspective, you'll become more charitable. So, yeah, they have that annoying quality, but they also have these good qualities. You know what I'm saying? If you can get away from that vein of how they relate to you, through the lens of your personal history with them, but rather as being these are two people who are struggling to do the best they can and, you know, dealing with what life has given them. And how are they doing? That's a different world to look at your parents as just people. That's a different perspective. And the bottom line is that, going back to the title, are you getting in your own way? Many people get in their own way by relating to their parents, seeing their parents through the entire spectrum of the entire history of their life. Yitzchak, at least initially here, looked at his son as, you know, maybe Yitzchak had a dream that he had two kinds of Yaakovs, but he was cool enough to recognize, like, hey, I got an introvert and I got an extrovert. I got a studious person. I got an outdoorsman kind of guy. Okay. And this outdoorsman seems to be a guy who's trying to use his qualities to, for the good. He's showing tremendous honor to his parents. That's a big deal. He's not just a ruffian. He didn't know. He was, you know, very subtly influenced, but Yitzchak's initial impulse is the right one, which is to look at people as people with their strengths and weaknesses, and be charitable and look at the situation in a broader perspective. And certainly with parents and your friends, it's a game changer. Your ability, your patience and your tolerance will shoot up much more. Because if you're just looking at your parents with a whole, as they say, from everything they did, every misdeed they did from Sheish Mei Breishis, from the 6 days of creation, you are going to be, this is an unpleasant relationship that's going to be unpleasant forever. Because you have all the books of memory, and then you did this, and you weren't there for this. The indictment never ends.
I can so relate to this, 100%.
That's it. So I'm not saying it's simple. I want to say, but if you can see people, step out of your own way, see people in a more broader perspective, look at your parents as people, you will have a lot more patience for them. All right, guys, have a great night. Any questions?
Thank you.
Oh, Rabbi, I find what you're saying about seeing our parents as people, but also an appreciation and gratitude for our parents, comes much more easily as we get older.
Yes. And I want to tell you why that is. Because as you start to go through some of the challenges, you start have to work in the workforce, and you're dealing with and you see that life is not so simple. And I used to think that they're a bunch of idiots. But then you see that what they had to deal with is very hard. And quite, you know, my estimation of them is increasing. That was the old Mark Twain joke. You know, when I was a kid, I thought my dad was an idiot. But as I get older, I see him, he's becoming more of a genius, because as you go through the same life experiences, you start to appreciate that, you know, they're better than I thought.
Rabbi, I also have a question on something we read tonight. It says Yitzchak was 60 years old when Rivka gave birth to Esav and Yaakov, but we don't know Rivka's age. Why does, we know the ages of Abraham and Sarah when they had kids, so why does the Torah blatantly omit Rivka's age?
Excellent question. So in general, when it omits information, it means that it's not critical for our understanding. Now, because Rivka, you know, because we need to know that Yitzhak's old because his oldness is part of his blindness and not able to detect where his son Esav is. And Rivka obviously is younger and being quite discerning is the king. So in other words, his oldness, his advanced, you know, starting to have kids when you're 60, the thought is exhausting just to think about that. You know, so, you know, that means when Asa's running around with his bow and arrow here, basically Yitzchak is pushing 80. And you see later on, he's losing his sight. So he's an old dude. And that is a critical part of the story. So his advanced age and his the fact that he's limited and not running around is a major factor. All right, guys, have a great night. I'll see you tomorrow night at MJE. All the best.